Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anlaw Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anlaw Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, as always, Adam Wilder. And today, as every single episode, we have a great guest. Of course, I'm talking about Major General Retired Chris Adams. Now, General Adams is part of our historical legacy series. He's going to be talking about his experience because he's the only person. General Adams is the only person I know that flew the B-36. He flew the B-52. He was a Minuteman I ICBM officer and then flew the B-52 again. And so we're going to be talking about the culture of SAC and what it was like to fly, you know, the B-36, the B-52, and to sit alert in that first solid-fueled ICBM and some of the... It was also, I think, Chris, in your... before you retired, you were the chief of staff at SAC, correct? I think that was one of your final
assignments. Yes, that was my last assignment in the Air Force and SAC.
So we're going to be talking about that today. And so if you like this and you're interested in some of our other historical podcasts that we've done, make sure to check out that legacy series. So, General, I am wondering, what was it like to fly the B-36? Tell me about that aircraft. It sort of has a storied reputation, but it wasn't around nearly as long as the B-52 has been. But tell me what that aircraft was like.
Well, as a very, very young 20-something second lieutenant to get aboard a crew of... Then 14 crew members. All the crew members were much older than me. Several of my aircraft commander, Jake Kaplan, was a World War II B-17 pilot, co-pilot, was also World War II, as were two of the Navigator bombardiers came out of World War II. So they were experienced aircraft crew members and what have you, and I was the novice, the baby on board, and there are three pilots in the B-36. The aircraft commander sat in the left seat. He was the king. In the right seat was the first pilot, and then number three, that happened to be me, was co-pilot. And so I get to sit on the jump seat quite a bit behind the aircraft commander and watch he and the pilot operate. To my right on the airplane were two flight engineers to operate those 10 engines. We had six reciprocating R4360 mega propeller engines and four J-47 jets. So it was quite a machine, heavy and could carry about anything that needed to be carried around the world.
And so why did this aircraft have three pilots? I mean, that's a unique configuration. So tell us about
well,
why.
It was. It's just the way that it was set up at the time by the folks in Strategic Air Command that decided to, I suppose, set up the crew so that you always had a backup pilot that could slip into the seat. The sorties missions were quite long. Not unusual having 24, 30 hours in length. And people get tired sitting in the seat after that long. And so the AC would get out. First pilot would take over command of the aircraft. And then young co-pilot like me would get to pop up in the seat and watch everything operate. And you do that for a couple of 3 years, and you begin to get a grasp of it yourself. And I'll never forget the time I was in the left seat. Aircraft commander was sitting on the jump seat behind me, and the first pilot was over in his right-hand seat, and we were descending down to land in El Paso at Biggs Air Force Base, And I kept waiting for him to tap me on the shoulder and get out of the seat. And he didn't tap me on the shoulder. He said, go ahead and let's enter base leg. So I entered base leg down toward downwind. I kept waiting to get out of the seat as quick as I could. And then finally he tapped me on the shoulder and said, take it on in. So I made my first landing in that monstrous airplane, which was an experience of a lifetime. And put it on the ground successfully, safely, taxied in, got out of it, soaking wet, but it was a fun day. So it was a mighty airplane, very powerful. It could carry anything weapons-wise. And all of our weapons at the time were the basic atomic weapons of the World War II generation, the old Mod 5, Mod 6, Mod 5, those weapons. We carried no nukes on the B-36.
So, you for those who have been watching Masters of the Air on Apple TV lately, you know, which looks at the storied 8th Air Force, and you see so many of the pilots and crew, you know, they're killed by flak or, any aircraft fire. I'm just curious if the reason you would have an extra pilot is for, a very World War II like example of if you had, a pilot killed, that you would have, he's killed through any aircraft fire, and then you would have somebody to replace.
Always have a backup, right? We had three Navigator bombardiers. We had the primary bombardier, and then we had the Navigator behind him, and then we had a young officer similar to my position, was a co-observer, and he sat and co-observed the two seniors, the bombardier and the Navigator. So he was a backup, as I was a backup to the other two pilots.
Huh. Now, what would you say was probably the most interesting or different or challenging thing about the B-36? What was there anything that really sort of made it special or hard to fly, or was there anything about the B-36 that made it special or made it, that perhaps most Americans who might be listening to this podcast, maybe they don't know about it?
Well, it was just a mighty airplane of the time and of that era coming out of World War II, with the old airplane B-17, B-24, and what have you, and this was a bomber that was designed toward the end of World War II and slipped in and took the place of the B-17, B-24, and became the stalemate of Strategic Air Command, thanks in great part to General Curtis LeMay, who really was the father of SAC, or Strategic Air Command, if you will, and really coaxed that airplane along to fill the requirement, of having a strategic capability, strategic bomb capability, and B-36 filled that. The B-47 sidled along the development of the 36, and it was flown by another group of people flying B-47s, a smaller bomber, jet bomber all the way, and then out of the 47, of course, graduated the B-52.
So tell me about the B-52, because the B-52 in its day was, it was a marvel. And so when you're going from a B-36 to now piloting the B-52, that had to be, quite the transition. So tell me about that, what that was like. And then what was it like flying those early models of the B-52?
Well, it was like graduating, from your old 1935 Chevy to a 1955 or so, 1960 vehicle, brand new, all the equipment is new. No, the B-52 was a Cadillac amongst aircraft at the time, and it was just like slipping into a brand spanking new automobile and getting it to fly it and do all the things that that you did, the strategic operations, carrying weapons, performing alert, and doing all the things we did in the 36 was just a transition over to a much highly rated, better equipped aircraft to do the job and to create and to develop or to provide the strategic capability that we needed at the time during the Cold War.
Now, if you think about the B-52 in those first models with the B-52 of today. And we've done so much to upgrade the B-52 today. Do you have any thoughts in terms of sort of the lifespan of this aircraft and, you know, it's the longevity that it's had in, you know, staying in service and being a productive aircraft for the Air Force?
Well, as long as they continue to upgrade the aircraft, which they do, replacing engines, upgrading the engines, upgrading the bomb nav system and things of that nature, their basic airframe is there to stay, although there are newer, later model airframes than the original ones, but it's just a continuum upgrading what you have with a power source and bomb nav systems, you know.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Yeah, now, you made the transition. You're one of the few people that I know. You might be the only person I know who's ever moved from a B-52 to a Minuteman silo. Tell me about that and what led to that. And then what was that like to go from flying to then sitting in that silo? How did that transition work? How was that different?
Well, it was most unusual because I finished my B-52 assignment after 4 years, and that opportunity popped up and I took it. There were other opportunities I might have taken. I don't remember exactly what all of them were, but the Minuteman had just made its introduction. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I went to Vandenberg, went to school, and learned how the Minuteman missile operated. Ended up as a crew commander of a two-man crew, as a crew commander and a deputy missile commander, if you will. And we began to perform alert. I was at Rapid City, South Dakota, Ellsworth Air Force Base. We had Minuteman missiles scattered all over South Dakota, you know. And so we went out, performed alert. 24-hour alert was the limit. You drove out in the morning in a vehicle or taxied out in a vehicle, relieved the other crew, go on duty for 24, and then you're relieved. And you did that about three times a week, two to three times a week. Transition was okay, just different equipment. You sat at a console underground as opposed to sitting at a console in an aircraft, you know, and flying it. The system basically, equipment-wise or technology-wise, is about the same. You could launch a missile from there as if you could drop a bomb from an airplane, you know. And so, but you were in one place all the time. You didn't leave. You didn't move. And we were about 60 feet underground in a steel silo, two-man crew. And we stayed awake for 24 hours and then one relieving the other, but more or less awake all the time. You didn't go to bed, didn't go to sleep. You were there on call, and you got tested occasionally by the headquarters system would give you a check call, test call, make sure everything's okay. But it was okay. It was interesting. I was there 3 years, and then Vietnam came along, and it was back to the cockpit for me, and I took off over there then for two tours. And you just keep moving on your career, you know, to the next step, and it's handed to you. You can't reject it. I guess you could, but you don't dare reject it. And you don't know what opportunity lies around the corner. And I was just a lucky young kid from Tomball.
So for you as somebody who spent your career in SAC, and, you know, we're so used to talking about U.S. Strategic Command that, you know, we don't really think that frequently about SAC, although some, you know, there are folks who have memories of SAC and they spent their early years in SAC and then saw the end of the Cold War and the transition And then, but for you, you were sort of in SAC at those very pivotal years and got to do a lot of firsts. And so I wonder, can you, for listeners who, you know, they've never been in the Air Force, they really have no sense of what SAC was like. Can you describe for us in those sort of pivotal early years, because you retired as the chief of staff at Strategic Air Command in the early 80s. And so talk us through what all of those pivotal decades during the height of the Cold War in Strategic Air Command, what was that like? What was the culture like? How was the mission perceived? Tell us about that.
Well, the mission was what I found to be highly structured, challenging, but highly motivated too by the leadership we had at the time. As I said, General Curtis LeMay was really the father of Strategic Air Command. He wasn't the first commander, but he stayed there long enough to develop into what it became the most professional force, I think, that the Air Force ever had. Now, some people may argue that, but I argue that it was professional, disciplined, and what have you. So growing up, as I did, from a young officer up to a senior officer, all of that stood with me and began to respect it more and more and help train the young kids that came along as young pilots, young missileers, and what have you. And it was very difficult on the families, I'll say that. We pulled alert all too frequently, a week at a time usually. I deployed to Guam, I don't know how many times over my B-36 career. We went to Guam, stayed 3 months, came back, maybe stayed home on alert back in the States for 3 to 6 months, and back to Guam again. And that's where our primary alert was for standing against the Cold War in the Pacific. In the B-52, later on, we deployed to the European area, to Africa, England, and what have you. And we performed alert there in the B-52 in the same manner, but not 3 months at a time. Usually a week at a time was about it. We'd fly in, fly out, and relieve the other crew. But it was a very disciplined society, much more so than today from what I hear and see and witness, much more disciplined. I mean, everybody was on the mark, knew what the responsibilities were and carried them out. And it was really a tremendous experience for me, taught me a great deal about discipline, responsibility, and what have you. And it wasn't a matter of being pushed on us. It was just a matter we absorbed it as we went along. We felt a sense of responsibility for what our jobs were. If we got promoted, great. If we didn't, then we stood the course and moved on where we were and still appreciated it until it was time to, you know, do something else. I was very fortunate to go from the 36 to the 52, went into Minuteman for a while. And then I went to Southeast Asia and finished that two tours over there back to back and came home to another world, which happened to get me into the atomic and nuclear technology area. For some reason, just to share this story with you, I was in Thailand, Karat, Thailand, Southeast Asia, my second assignment. Awaiting my assignment to come home. Second year was up. And I kept waiting. And I get a call from personnel one day and said, I have your stateside assignment. You're going to Joint Task Force 8, Sandia, New Mexico. And I said, what is that? And he didn't know. And I didn't know. So I came back to the States, picked up the family, moved to Albuquerque, and found Sandia Base attached to Kirtland Air Force Base on the south side of Albuquerque, and discovered that Joint Task Force was a nuclear task force operating out of Washington out of the Defense Nuclear Agency. And I was a young lieutenant colonel then and began to learn a great deal about the development of nuclear weapons, number one, but number two, the employment of nuclear weapons and the size of weapons you use to hit the size of target you were going to. We did that study and analysis there in Joint Task Force in Albuquerque. Well, I did that for 3 years, and then I was hailed up to Washington to Defense Nuclear Agency headquarters, which was a surprise to me, but went to Washington then. And lo and behold, the good Lord takes care of foods and little children. My mother used to tell me that. I'm sitting there after about 3 weeks. I get a call and says, the Admiral wants to see you. So I went up to see the three-star Admiral, Vice Admiral Mustin, was the director of Defense Nuclear Agency. He called me in his office. I had no idea what. He said, well, I hear good things about you down in Sandia. Yes, sir. Quick conversation. I don't know. He said, I want you to be my executive officer. So I became exec then to the three-star Admiral in an Air Force suit, which is different. But anyway, I was also assistant chief of staff to the Navy chief of staff of the Defense Nuclear Agency. But we had an Air Force two-star vice commander. So it was really a joint operation, all doing the same thing in the name of nuclear weapons, really deployment and employment, and worked very closely with Strategic Air Command, worked very closely with the Navy submarine force, of course. They had nukes, and as did SAC and its bombs. So it really an experience just fell out of the blue. I have no idea, you know, that was happening to me at the time. I just absorbed it and took to it very fortunately and enjoyed every bit of it. And one thing led to the other, and it became another large chunk of my career. And then eventually was hailed back to SAC then to command a missile wing. And then an air division. I had three B-52 wings and three wings of tankers, and commanded that air division then for better part of 3 years. And then I was called up to headquarters SAC toward the end of my career as director of plans and policy. But also at that time, Strategic Air Command had a three-star Navy admiral there who worked the Navy side of the nuclear business. And so I became his executive, if you will, or assistant director, they call me. And it was an interesting job. I reported to the four-star with one side of my head and the Navy three-star to the other side of it. It made it quite an interesting experience.
Yeah. So
that probably more than you needed to know there, or more you even wanted to know.
So Annie Jacobson has a new book out called Nuclear War, a Scenario. And one of the things she talks about, because she interviews a bunch of retired, you know, Bill Perry and a bunch of, you know, Cold Warriors. And one of the terms uses to describe officers in the nuclear world is trained monkeys or monkeys with a checklist.
Yeah, I would take that as an insult.
So go ahead. Could you, you know, respond to this misnomer that's really what, you know, what nuclear airmen are? And she's talking about modern airmen. And the perception of SAC was that it was even worse then. Could you perhaps respond to that?
Well, I'd say, in a word, disciplined warriors, disciplined men and women who voluntarily step forward. There's no draft, hasn't been one for years, but disciplined men and women who learn their professions and work at their professions and do it. I'm not that close to the operations now, but I'm quite sure that it's still reasonably disciplined as it was then. I would really take as an insult the monkey. And because we weren't monkeys, we were highly well-trained and responsive adults in every case, and did the job, did the deed we needed to do. And I can understand that. A lot of people stand off to one side and can poke fun at because they don't know what they're going. And I presume, well, I know you can find anybody to talk to and put something down very easily. So you find you a monkey to make up a story for you, and then you go from there, you see. So, no, extremely disciplined from the very beginning. And I have to presume to today, because I'm not there now and I'm not that close to it any longer. I have no more colleagues there. They're all beyond me and older. I would really reject that analysis of her or presumption of hers. And I'm surprised if she got anything like that if she talked to Bill Perry, but Perry was very much a warrior, you know, even as an Air Force officer and a governor. But
so let me, because we're running out of time, bring out Bob, the magic genie, and rub my magic lamp. And, you know, Bob, he comes for all guests on NucleCast, and he grants three wishes, as you probably know. So, Chris, let me ask you, if you think about it, what would, and you know, the wishes are related to the topics we've been discussing, and you could forecast to the future if you want as well. But what would your wish number one be from Bob the Magic Genie?
Well, I think number one wish would be a strong United States military deterrent force. We have enemies all around us now, perhaps more than ever, Russia being number I presume number one. You've got them all around us on all sides, the little dinky-dinky countries out there. But the most important thing we need is a professional military force headed up by professional leaders. And we have to presume that those we're raising today, and they were in babies in high school when I retired, that they are just as strong-willed and determined and disciplined as they need to be for the job to be done today.
Okay. All right. So that's a good wish. How about wish number two?
Well, wish number two is to have a continuing country and society as we have today. We've got a lot of flaws in it. I'd like to clean a lot of them up and make it more more stable, more interactive amongst the people in it, and get rid of politics, and let's worry about the country itself, the nation, and preserve it the very best we can for our kids coming
along. Okay, another good wish. And then your final wish. And this is one, you know, Bob, you know, only grants three, so make this one a good one.
Well, a good one, I guess, would sum up the two that I just made, and that is to good Lord, protect us, watch over us, make us smarter day by day by day, and in turn stronger to protect what we have in this United States of America. I've traveled all over the world. I've been to China. I spent 5 years working in Russia a few years ago. I've seen all sorts of the world, maybe more so than many have. I've been to China and observed that. And I don't mean just as a tourist, but I mean I've observed, I've been down there. But for gosh sakes, preserve ourselves, what we have, our basis for even being here, and keep America great.
Okay. Now, for many Americans, as we sort of discussed, there's a lack of understanding of the Cold War. Because most Americans, if you think about it, the majority of Americans weren't alive when the Cold War ended. And you know, if you think about Strategic Air Command as well, there are very few active duty officers who began their careers in SAC. So, well, I just want to thank Major General Chris Adams. Thanks for joining us on this show, and thanks for...
Well, thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
This has been a production of the Anwar Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Channington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.